Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody, and welcome aboard. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with our genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, I'd like to invite you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page and join us with the rest of the usual suspects in the chat room. If you have some observations or questions for ourselves or our guest as we go through, just ask for you to fold it in there. Eagle One will be riding herd as usual, and we'll try to bring those into our conversation. Also, if you're new to Midrats and you would like to catch up on your previous shows, or if you got to leave halfway through this show and want to see what you missed, you can always go into the archive on Blog Talk Radio or subscribe on iTunes and get the show there. And as many of the usual suspects know, this show, it goes 60 minutes, and that's it when you're live. Many times when our guests are having a point and we don't want to step on their toes, they'll keep talking, and we may ask a follow-on question that goes beyond 60 minutes. So if that takes place, go into the archive, download the show, go to the 60-minute mark, because sometimes this show can go a few minutes. We've gone as far as an hour and 15, and you can't get that live, but you can't get it on an archive. Just a little detail there for everyone. Now let's get on with the show. Now what we would like to do today, and as those who read our little post about the upcoming show, we're going to have two guests today, we hope. But we're having a little problem with our friend Chuck, getting in touch with him. It's a little bit you know, maybe he's getting his back waxed or something out there in Hawaii. But we're also having little technical problems on this end. And our second guest will be Seth Crosby from the Hudson Institute, who will be coming on to discuss his latest article. And he has a busy afternoon, so we really can't call him until the bottom of the hour. But to do that, we got to fix some software issues. So until then, Eagle One and myself are just going to have a little talk until we can get our friend Chuck on the line. So Eagle One, are you ready to tap dance? Okay. Dr. Heal Thyself. Let's see here. Eagle One.
I'm here.
Ah, there we go. I thought I was going to Billy Idol and be dancing by myself here for a little bit. But, hey, did you hear everything I said during the intro?
I think so.
Okay, good deal. Well, one good thing about this particular area that we like to talk about on Midrats is the fact we're never short on things to talk about. And, you know, maybe we'll get to Egypt and the Suez Canal and everything like that. But being that you are the Navy Milblogs Ophir piracy SME, I wonder if you could just talk for a couple minutes about, while everything else has been sucking all the oxygen up, what are our latest developments on the piracy front that you think some of our listeners might be interested in?
Well, I'm sure the thing that most of the Americans are interested in is the recent hijacking of an American yacht with apparently four Americans on board. Yacht was en route from India to Oman and was hijacked. Apparently now it was en route to Somalia. There are rumors that there's a warship trailing along, although we don't really know which ship and what the plan is, but that's the situation as I understand it. The yacht was on a normal round the world. There apparently these people have been living on board this yacht since the last 7 or 8 years, and maybe even longer than that. And they traveled the world from port to port. And they were on a fairly routine trip. Should have been a fairly routine trip. into the Mediterranean, where they're planning to visit some of the Greek and Turkish islands in the Mediterranean. And, of course, they didn't make it. To add fun to the mix, they apparently also are carrying a number of Bibles with them because they're missionaries, and that I don't know how that will play into if there's any Islamic influence among the pirates. That may come to play, but I think the key thing, if you're a Somali pirate, and this happened right after the sentencing of the pirate in New York to 34 years in prison for, not for piracy, but for all the other kidnapping acts and all the rest of it, there may be a sort of revenge factor that will be invoked by the pirates on these Americans. And the question then is, you know, is this that big a deal? It's four people out of over 600, I think, that the almost 800 that the pirates have currently held hostage on their ships. And this just happens that these are Americans. And, you know, it's one of those calls that if I were commander-in-chief, it would be a very hard thing to worry about. They're on a 65-foot yacht, and the issue is whether or not, you know, there's going to be some kind of rescue attempt or whether they're going to go through the normal routine of waiting for a ransom demand.
Hey,
so,
and
in addition to that, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just wanted to let you know, Eagle One, I thought I had Chuck here for a minute, but we look like we dropped sync, so I got to hop off and see if I can get Chuck back.
Okay. I'll continue to tap dance. So, you know, part of the question always in a situation like this is what kind of action do you undertake, and is it at a higher risk to the hostages than just letting them go through the normal routine of being hostages and a ransom demand and all that stuff. These are not the only yachts, people, that have ever been captured by these pirates. We had the French yacht that was taken. We've had a couple of other yachts. Some South Africans are currently being held by the Somali pirates. And there have been some others who have also been taken. Some of those, as you know, there was an English couple who were recently released after a ransom was paid. And the policy of the British government was, we're not going to negotiate with these hostages. But eventually the couple was released. And it went through a pretty harrowing time, it sounds like. And, you know, among other things that have happened recently, there's been more and more news about the maltreatment by the pirates of the hostages they've taken. And how unpleasant an experience it is being a hostage held by the Somali pirates. As more and more of the clans in Somalia get involved in the piracy, then there's going to be kind of a shift in the focus of the pirates as to how they treat, could be a shift as to how they treat their hostages. Before, the hostages were the most valuable thing. The ships were almost irrelevant in terms of the ransom demand because even though they're worth a lot of money, that nobody wanted to see the sailors on board the ship get injured or killed. Pirates lately have been a lot more ruthless. There have been a few killings and a lot more shooting, but we'll just have to see how it goes. You know, since the French landed on the shores of Somalia and killed a few pirates and took the money back, some of the money back from one of the ransom efforts, you might note that the French have been pretty much left alone. Are you back with Chuck yet?
Yep, we sure are. And we have Chuck on the line. Just wanted to introduce everybody as we were fighting through it all. We have finally found him in the midst of the pineapple fields. We've got our first guest today that we'll catch for the rest of the first half of the hour. Should be well known to most everybody who bounces around the Mill Blog community. It's Major Chuck Ziegenfuss, United States Army. You can catch up with his stuff from his blog, From My Position on the Way. Chuck, welcome at last to MidRats.
Hi, and hello to all of your blue and brown water compatriots.
Well, thank you very much. We'll have our little joint session here this morning. And this is a great opportunity, I thought, and I kind of feel guilty that we haven't done it up till now because it's something that the Mill Blog community from early on has really supported well. And I guess it's due to your boyish charm and handsome good looks that in many ways you've become one of the major spokesmen for, I think, is a great example of the best of America, but also a bunch of people who like to sit and do free therapy at the computer, getting together and helping each other out. And that's the good people over at Soldiers, Angels, and Valor IT. And for those that aren't really up to speed with it, or maybe have just, you know, thrown a few shekels in the jar when they've seen the pleas to help out, tell everybody what they do or what we do and how that actually translates to the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and marine who find themselves in recovery but want to get back in touch with the rest of the world as they have become accustomed to.
Well, what you just said there is they've become accustomed to really hits the nail on the head. When I was wounded in 05, I was blogging, you know, back in the Wild West days. And, one of the most important things for me was to be able to communicate with my soldiers forward and also to be able to, you know, email people and write on my blog and do all the things that we normally do. I mean, for most of us, when we wake up in the morning, the first thing we do is we fire up the machine and check our emails, texts, Facebook, you know, you name it. And it's just kind of a part of life. And then I was wounded and I was unable to use my hands because one of them was half gone and the other one, they still hadn't reattached my thumb. And, which is a story in and of itself, but, I got a phone call from Soldiers Angels and they said, and it was actually the founder, Patty Bader, and they had been sending care packages to some of my soldiers that weren't getting any mail. And, but she said, "Hey, you know, we heard you were wounded. Is there anything we can do for you?" And that was actually the second angel that I met in the hospital. The first one was a lady named Kathleen that was there just so that there would be someone there when I woke up, which was really cool. There was also angels in Germany that did the same thing. Mrs. Greyhawk was the one that lorded over me while I was there. Unfortunately, for the 4 days that I was there, I don't remember all the maybe 15 minutes of it, but I remember her. Anyway,
she's hard to forget.
So, you know, she's very hard to forget. Patty called me and said, you know, what can we do for you? And I said, well, I'd really like a laptop so I can stay in touch with my guys. And Patty has this amazing, I don't know if it's a habit or if it's more innate, but she has the inability to say no. And so she said, let me see what I can do. And she talked to the board, and the board said, sure, you can use $600 to get him a laptop. Patty called me back and she said, okay, I've got the approval to use this money and I'm on eBay right now. I've never used eBay before. Talk me through what you need. You got to realize I'm stoned out of my gourd on the best narcotics that money can buy. And I'm talking to a lady in California who's never used eBay, and I've, you know, not a big eBay fan myself. So we talked through what was available and, you know, finally said, okay, that one's good. Send it to me. Well, she sent me the laptop. And my wife set it up. And now you got to remember, at the time, the only computer that was available to any of the wounded was a desktop computer that was down the hall in a room, which is all well and good, but when you can't get out of bed because you don't have skin on parts of your body anymore that they haven't replaced yet, that doesn't do you a whole lot of good. And, you know, aside from not being able to use your hands. So I get this laptop. My wife sets it up in front of me, and my arm, my left arm is bandaged up and pretty immobile. My right arm is casted up and also pretty immobile, but I had one finger that I could use. It gets really hard to type when you can only use one finger and you have to lift the cast to do it. And so after a couple of, you know, attempts at emailing and blogging and things like that, I just said, look, I know of this software that's out there called Dragon Naturally Speaking. And I'd really appreciate it if somebody would throw a few shekels in the jar so that I could get it. And one of the guys that reads my blog, within 8 hours, had posted the money to my Amazon account to buy the software, which was amazing. And I bought the software, got it delivered in a couple days, and despite being drugged out of my skull, and I'm serious, the drugs were really good. Despite that, I was able to install the software and get it working, all by myself. And within minutes, I was able to use a computer with just my voice to do everything that you can do with a keyboard and mouse. And it was like the world opened back up for me. You know, it was, for me, a mental leap of, you know, I can still do something that I used to do instead of lay in a hospital bed and wish the air conditioning at Walter Reed worked. And so I talked to Patty a few days after that, and she had, you know, I had emailed her and everything and said, hey, I'm doing all this with my voice. And I said, this is great. Is there any way that we can do this for the other 40-odd service members that are up on this ward? And Patty being Patty and having an inability to say no, she said, let me look into it, and we'll see what we can do. And we originally planned to have lending libraries at the major medical centers where, you know, guys would get a laptop and a machine, and they would check it out, and they could use it and then turn it back in. Well, the issue there was that they couldn't maintain a library of equipment that was not owned by the government, and the government wasn't about to take a bunch of donated computers and then have responsibility for them. So Patty and I said, okay, well, we'll just buy them the machines and the software. And that's what we started doing. And, of course, the problem there became money. And we're not talking, you know, top-of-the-line Alienware laptops. We're talking has enough RAM and processor speed to run the software. And the Dragon, naturally speaking, software is resource-intensive, I'll give it that. But it's gotten a lot better since then. I think the top version then was 7, and now they're running, I think, Dragon 11, which is incredibly, incredibly user-friendly and, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of what I was doing. Now the government has a program in place called the CAP program, which actually helps provide the laptops eventually, but they won't provide the software. So we buy the software outright for people that need it, and in cases where the government's going to take their sweet-ass time, not that the government's slow or anything, but, I mean, come on, it's the government.
It is.
I don't know how things are on the Navy side, but I know that, you know, there's always paperwork and approvals and, you know, just a long line of people that have to bless off on buying a roll of toilet paper, let alone a computer. And so sometimes we just buy the computer outright as well, and they are donated to the service members that have hand or eye injuries or brain injuries that don't allow them to otherwise use a computer. And I remember at one point, I went in to see a couple of guys from Special Forces that had been wounded. And these guys, you know, both in bed, both like I was drugged out of their skulls. And I was still in the hospital at the time. I was getting better. And I had, you know, skin reapplied to my legs and arms so I could get up and move around. And I just went in to talk to them because I was bored and I used to wander the halls, which really pissed off the nurses. And they were both in that same boat that I had been in, and couldn't use their arms, and one guy had shrapnel in his eye. And so I called Patty and said, hey, I got two more for you. And we got him the machines, and a nurse came in after we got the machines, got them set up and everything, and she was like, it's amazing. They've actually asked to have their meds reduced so that they can stay online and you know, use the computers. And that's a huge leap, because the funny thing about the body and pain and drugs is drugs are great for alleviating pain. Pain is the way the body knows that something's hurt. So if you're drugged out of your skull to stop the pain, that's great. You're not in pain, but your body doesn't fix things as fast. So these guys scaling back their meds actually helped them heal faster. And this went on for a few months. I left the hospital in August of that year, and then in November, and this was 05, in November, the Mill Bloggers started the first donation drive over Veterans Day weekend, and we raised $100,000, which I was like, great, the program's taken care of. Well, that's not exactly, you know, true. The program wasn't taken care of with just $100,000, but it gave us enough money to get through a year. And about a year and a half later, I was back at Walter Reed for another surgery. And we gave out our 1,000th laptop. And so we had a big barbecue and had a bunch of the wounded guys there. And you know how it is trying to corral soldiers or sailors? Well, same kind of thing, and just add drugs into the mix. And you know, everybody's talking, we're trying to get their attention and everything. I remember I stood up on a bench and I said, all right, you cripples, listen up. And, you know, you could have heard a pin drop. Who's this asshole calling us a cripple? And then I waved at him with my left hand, and they're like, oh, okay, he's one of us. It's cool. And so we, you know, presented the, like, 20 or so laptops that we had. And we just kept doing this. And we would go over to Bethesda. And when I say we, not me, you know, I have my day job. But Angels would go over to Bethesda. They'd go to Brooke Army Medical Center, you know, you name the military hospital, and there's Angels there. And, you know, we have case managers that work with the Angels that say, yes, this person, you know, needs this equipment. So it's not like we're just giving them to everybody that walks in the door. It's the Valor IT program under Soldiers Angels. One of the cool things about it, and I kind of demanded this when we set it up, was that any money that's donated for Valor IT only goes to the Valor IT program. So all of the other projects under Soldiers Angels don't touch it. The operating funds for Soldiers Angels don't touch it. It's just to provide the software, the laptops. We now do and with the new motion-sensitive game consoles, we use those because it's amazing how much that helps you learn to use your hands again without thinking about it, which is the goal. I can focus on something and try and pick it up with my left hand, and that's okay, but that's not getting back to normal lifestyle, to where, you know, you pick something up without thinking about how to make your hand move in a certain way.
It's an additional form of physical therapy than what they're getting during their designated slot.
Absolutely, and we put game systems in a lot of the major medical facilities, and, you know, the guys stay. You know, they do their hour of having the occupational therapist bend and twist and pull and try and make them scream. Note on that, if you ever have to go to physical or occupational therapy, screaming only encourages the therapist. I swear those folks have a whole closet full of leather gear at home and they're into pain. But yeah, the soldiers would stay after their appointment time and, you know, just sit down and they'd play the Xbox or the Wii or whatever was there. Because, I mean, these are 19, 20-year-old kids. That's their lifestyle. That's what they do. I'll play Black Ops every now and again too. But these guys, one of the first questions they ask when I give them a machine is like, "Oh, can I get on Facebook with this? Or can I chat with this?" And absolutely, and I'll show you how. About 6 months ago, I stopped at Walter Reed and went in and talked to a kid who had lost his right arm, both legs, and his left arm was pretty mangled as well. And he was miserable. And I went in, I sat with him for about a half hour. He was just out of surgery that day, so I knew he wasn't going to be up to any long kind of conversation. And while I sat there and talked to him, I said, "Hey, man, you know, we got a lot in common." And he looked at me and he says, "Well, how do you figure?" I said, "Well, one, you're in my bed." And he looked at me and I said, "You know, 5 years ago, this was my bed." And as I'm talking, I'm setting up the laptop for him, and his aunt's sitting next to him, and I said, "You know, things look pretty bleak right now." I said, "But they're going to get better. You know, life is going to be different. It's not going to be what you had in your head 2 months ago. Life's going to be different, but it's going to go on, and it's going to be better than what it is right now." And as we talked, he kind of opened up a little bit, and I wasn't expecting any kind of huge Helen Keller type revelations here or anything, and then I put the headset on him and I said, "Hey, you know, just say these words." And I was telling him the commands to use. And, you know, I told him to move the mouse and to double click. And, you know, we got him into his Facebook account. And it was amazing. It was just like when you put any other 19-year-old in front of a computer. They automatically tune you out and go to whatever it is they're doing. You know, like when I talk to my 8-year or my 11-year-old son, and he's got a Wii game controller in his hand. Whatever. Yeah, got it. He woke up, he started using the machine, and the only time he stopped to talk to anybody was when he was asking me, "Okay, now how do I make it do this?" And his aunt was just amazed. She's like, "He's been just laying there, not talking, just, you know, not wanting to do anything. And she goes, now he looks like he did 2 months ago.
Mission accomplished.
And it's that kind of amazing thing that happens every day. And in 5 years, we're now heading toward our 6,000th laptop. And that doesn't include when we've just bought the software or when we've just bought a gaming system or when we've, you know, bought a GPS for somebody that's got, you know, really bad traumatic brain injury and can't remember where they are. And that's kind of bad when you've got service members that have to go between Bethesda and Walter Reed for these different appointments. And this happens, and guys get on the metro or they take a bus or something like that, and they forget. They just, it's not there. It's the hardest thing to understand. It's kind of like having Alzheimer's to a degree. And then they've got this thing in their hand that says, oh, okay, this is where I'm going. And it takes them there, you know. And we've done all sorts of things like that, trying to leverage technology to make up for physical shortcomings. And we've been really successful. The problem is, you know, people keep getting hurt. You know? And so there's a continual need that needs to be met. And so that's why we keep doing the fund drives. And we shifted away from, this year we're shifting away from November, when you've also got to compete with every other charity that's doing something for either Thanksgiving or for Christmas or for Veterans Day. So we're shifting to tax time, April 1st to the 10th, or 1st to the 15th, rather, so that people can say, okay, last year I got screwed on my taxes, and next year I'm probably going to get screwed on my taxes as well. However, I'm going to make a donation to Soldiers Angels, which is a 501c3 charity, and that's all going to be tax deductible next year. So,
well, this is Eagle One, Tex. Let me interrupt you for a second. And the Valor IT thing is going to kick off in April. But in addition to the laptop computers, Soldiers Angels also gives backpacks for the wounded, and then there's another program about Heroes for Adoption. Can you talk about that for a couple of seconds?
Heroes for Adoption is really a cool thing, and I kind of opened with that when I was talking about my soldiers that weren't getting any mail. I had, I guess, maybe half a dozen guys in my company of 100 and some folks who just never got mail. And so when I first contacted Soldiers Angels, that's what I was looking for, was somebody to just, you know, write them a letter every now and again, maybe send them a package. And that's just the most amazing thing. And I know you guys, if anything gets delivered to the ship, it's mail. You know, that gets priority over everything except, I don't know what gets priority on ships, but I know that mail is a big one because it's a morale builder. And getting these letters, these, you know, any soldier letter kind of things, even for me, was a huge boost, because it was just somebody saying, hey, I know you're over there, and I care. And, you know, some guys will write back, and you get a great relationship, and I'm still in touch with three or four people that sent me mail while I was deployed. And some guys don't. You know, that's the hard thing, is people get discouraged because they say, well, I sent this guy a letter, and I sent him a care package, and I never heard back from him, and that happens, and I'm not going to shy away from it. I'm not going to address it, but they're not going to not address it. It happens. But what you have to realize is the important thing is you have made an effort to tell somebody that you care. And even if, you know, maybe they just weren't raised right, or, you know, maybe they get busy, or maybe there's so many things that happen on a deployment, they just forget. But you've made the effort to tell a soldier or a sailor or a Marine that you think what they're doing, whether you agree with the war or not, you think that what they're doing is the right thing, because they've stood up and they've said, you know, I will serve my nation, you know, instead of doing something stupid like going to, I don't know, Columbia University. They've made a sacrifice, and that's what you're recognizing with this adoption program. And it's as involved as you want it to be. It can be a couple of letters, you know, a one-page letter, something like that. It can be, I'm going to send somebody a care package every month. and you can adopt more than one soldier. You know, start with one, and I always say soldier because I'm in the Army. It's, I know it's not a joint approved term, but y'all understand.
It's a thought that counts.
It's just it's just an amazing thing to get a letter like that. I cherished those letters. I still have those letters, believe it or not, from when I was deployed. And I know that these guys, everybody that gets them, even if they don't write back, they really do appreciate it.
Hey Chuck, in the we got a couple minutes left here. I wanted to do a couple things. First of all, it's skips generations on my side of the family, but I also wanted to mention something that we see a lot in our line of work, is that regardless of what color your uniform is, that this really is a family business. In addition to your service, I understand your sister has Air Force service, and your father, Sergeant First Class Ziegenfuss, he also served in the Army. And as a sidebar, and it's sometimes...
And my grandfather was in the Navy. I'll actually mention that in public, so...
Well, but you do get joint credit then. You got it in your blood. But it's a cliche because, you know, everybody says, well, my spouse serves too. But I wanted to leave you with a couple of good little pennies here. I wanted you to throw a little love to your wife and let everybody know the special recognition that she got. And, you know, for every one person like Karen that gets recognized, she really stands for the thousands of women and husbands out there that really give that plus more to their spouses and their loved ones as they serve their nation. But also, what could the listener do to help Soldiers Angels and Valor IT going forward?
The biggest thing is spreading the word. You know, whether it's clearing out your email contacts and telling everybody, hey, I found out about this great charity, or whether it's, you know, dropping business cards in, you know, at whatever establishments you go to and writing a note on the back about it, or going to a business and saying, hey, there's this, you know, like going to your local Walmart or Sam's Club or whatever, dollar store, and saying, hey, there's this charity that's collecting toiletries for backpacks for the wounded. What do you got? And you'd be surprised. Sometimes they'll take a cart and they'll fill it up and say, here you go. And then you just box it up and send it off to San Antonio to the warehouse, and they'll put it in backpacks and care packages and everything else. But it's the donation of time and effort is absolutely critical to what we do. And it doesn't take, you know, a 40-hour work week to do it. It's something that you can do at your leisure. That is the key, and it's getting people involved and keeping people involved and realizing that what you're doing for a higher purpose than yourself. And, you know, if visiting the wounded is your thing, then you can certainly do that. If it's writing letters is your thing, there's always that. But any kind of contribution you can make to help is a contribution that we need.
Amen. And Chuck, thank you for taking time this Sunday to get away from the Aloha spirit for a minute and coming on board and talking with us. And also, everybody should know that another thing about Chuck's generation in the Army is Chuck and a lot of his fellow soldiers, and it's true with everybody else who serves in their service, in spite of the fact that he was very wounded, he is still active duty. He is still serving his soldiers, which is right where he belongs. So, Chuck, thank you for leaning in, and thank you for helping out the soldiers. And I look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck.
Talk to you later. Mm-hmm. Take
care. And, everybody, that was, of course, Major Chuck Ziegenfuss, U.S. Army, out there in Hawaii. So, aloha to him. And on most of the MilBlog sites, you'll see once a year, a couple times a year, there'll be a big push for Valor IT and Soldiers Angels. But you can find them 24/7, 365. If you found out you've just got a bonus and you wanted to take a decimal point of that and contribute, it helps people like Chuck. It helps serve those who serve us. Can't recommend it enough for everybody. And, hey, we're going to shift from the very specific and the very individual down to more of a macro view with a returning guest to MidRats. Seth Crosby. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Seth, welcome back to MidRats.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. I'll tell you what, when I saw your article, and you, for the listeners, you can find it over on my home blog. There's a link to his article in World Affairs titled Anchors Away, American Sea Power in Dry Dock. I just started reading it, and I got halfway through it, and I saw your name up at the top. Continue reading the rest. And based upon some conversations I have had with some other people over the last month, the discussions of the grand strategy and what's next, and America, as regardless of what you say, we remain a mercantile maritime power, and this fog and this haze around a grand strategy and the purpose of the Navy and the challenges going forward, it's something that people are talking about more and more, and I thought you encapsulated that really well in your article. And for the listeners who have a reading, I just want to tease something up for you. I'm going to quote you to yourself. And you start off the article with the following. After 21 years have passed since the United States invaded Panama to remove military dictator Manuel Antonio Noriega, the U.S. has been in war for 14 of those years. And these mostly ground-based operations reflect and reinforce the United States' unarticulated drift towards a national security strategy that sometimes looks like a grand whack-a-mole game. What is our grand strategy right now if somebody wanted to put it up on a 3x5 cards? And is that really putting us on a firm footing for where this nation needs to be in 2011?
I think you need several file cards. And that means that what the grand strategy is that the question isn't answered. We're trying to do a lot of things at one time, and nobody's really articulated, at least at the national level, how these all fit together or whether they fit together. And that's what a strategy should do. It should articulate interests and answer them with some sort of a large plan. The article argues that we're increasingly focused on the crisis of the flavor of the year, the flavor of the half decade. So there's a problem in Afghanistan, and we're after that. And there's a problem in Iraq, and we're after that, or else. Now there are increasing problems in the Middle East, and that's why a larger idea of what we're about is necessary. And I don't think we have that right now, and so I don't think your file card, I mean, it's a good idea. I agree with it. We should be able to say that in a word, but I'm not sure we can.
Seth, this is Eagle One. When I read your piece and what I consider to be a companion piece from the U.S. Navy in Distress article you wrote for Strategic Analysis, you talk about the need for us to have a strategy, and you indicate in the article that Sal was talking about the rise of a dominant power in Asia as a focus for that strategy, but how much is our strategy, to the extent that we have one, is driven by the fact that we've ridden really roughshod over our Navy and our naval personnel in the last 15 or 20 years?
Well, that's a problem, and that's what I'm trying to get people to look at. Not just the informed community like your listeners and viewers, but the larger community, because I don't think that that understanding exists there. I think that the people are focused on the wars in the Middle East and terrorism, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying we should ignore that. I'm just saying that if we ignore the other, which is the increasing threat that as China becomes bigger and more powerful and throws its weight around more in the Western Pacific, that we're going to miss the forest for the trees. And that's the problem. So I don't know, how do you get people to recognize that? I think what you're doing helps a great deal. Talk about it and get people to focus on it. Think about what China's going to look like, what our contribution is, both positively and negatively. I mean, in something like, oh, I guess 6 or 7 years, the service on the debt that we owe the Chinese for what we've borrowed from them. In other words, you know, they buy our treasury bills, and so we have to pay them back. And the paying them back in will amount to close to what their total defense budget is today. Now, of course, their total defense budget is probably going to go up in 6 or 7 years, but it gives you an idea of the problem. We're going to be paying for their defense.
We have the authors
that we repay them on the debt that we owe them.
We had the authors of Red Star Over the Pacific on last month to talk about their book for the full hour. And that's one of the points that we talked about, is there is this debtor-debtee relationship that it's a challenge. And it's something that is part of a much larger problem. And we're going to see that stressor. And as the budget's constrained, we got to have the discussion of the Navy side of the house. And when you look at the Army side of the house, you brought up one of the great examples of what the Army's doing. You talked about how General Petraeus was intimately involved in the selection for the colonels and brigadier generals and trying to put his flavor on that. And when you look at the thinkers of the last decade for the Army, most people will get a flash. They'll go, okay, Petraeus, McMaster, Nagel, big influencers. If you put a bridge up there and say, okay, give me that flag officer, colonel, I know he just made brigadier, I think, a year and a half ago, and the retired lieutenant colonel. Give me the idea of people that are driving the direction of the Navy. And you get a pause. Occasionally people will mention a Stavridis, or maybe somebody else from one field or the other. But where do you see, if they exist, those people that are stepping forward with good ideas, trying to get a conversation started? And is that something that should happen in the open, or should it be something that happens behind closed door and then something pops out, like the maritime strategy a few years ago that I am not a big fan of? And I think the lack of a conversation here is pretty much tells you that it's not an effective document.
Well, I think you have to do it in both places. The subject has to take place in the open because it's of utmost importance to the United States, and it needs to take. And the Navy's tried to do that, as you know. I mean, there are these so-called national conversations or national discussions, whatever they were, about the maritime strategy when it was unrolled in 3 years ago almost. So trying to do that's not a bad idea. But when, for example, the maritime strategy doesn't mention the word China in it, then you have a problem. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, I'm not saying that that everything's going to be righted if the Navy starts to publicly say that China is an issue. I think that's important. I think it's necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient. There are other problems as well, not the least of which is what you just mentioned, which is budget cuts are looming. We have a big problem with finances in this country. As the CNO himself has pointed out, Admiral Ruffett has said in a speech, I think, a couple of weeks ago, that the ships that were built during the Reagan administration are going to have to be replaced in 2020. And where's the money going to come from? So if that discussion doesn't take place, then we're going to continue along the same road that we have, which is sort of, well, we're kind of muddled through. And I don't think you get a good strategy by muddling through. And I'm sure that you don't reverse the problem in shipbuilding by muddling through. So I think
one
it's extremely
things-
important, yeah, that that discussion take place and that people understand where Navy shipbuilding is going. If it can, if the price of ships continues as it has in the past, and if we run into a budget buzzsaw, as it looks as though we are, a big problem.
One of the things you noted in your World Affairs article was the fact that the budget right now, the defense budget, seems to be almost evenly split among the services, but that hasn't always been the case, and that doesn't have to be the case in the future, that at any given time, you may need to spend more money on, as I understand what you're saying, on ships and aircraft for the fleet, and less on Army forces, and use the example back in 1958 of SAC eating up, 48% of the budget. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Right, yeah. Well, the understanding of the budget when Eisenhower was president was jointness hadn't become the buzzword that it is today. Also, I think it's not a coincidence that the Eisenhower administration, or the president himself, took strategy very seriously. There was this, I mean, it's been publicized enough, but it's good to go over it again. There was a Solarium project that he undertook to get ideas out on the table about what the United States should do about the Soviet Union. The records show that he appointed senior people, not dozens, but a handful, and had them go over various different ideas, and he attended in person all the working meetings, or almost all the working meetings of that group, and made decisions himself that led to the successful strategy of containment. And I think that with challenges proliferating and budget problems, that's a good approach for the United States today, for the senior leadership, president and high command, to have a series of discussions like that, and to come up with ideas that will answer the question, you know, what do we do? What is the strategy? And that should be reflected. And you don't produce something like that and have no impact on the budget. Now, the budget is affected by that. And if your decision is, which I think makes sense, if your decision is that some things are take more money or require spending more now than others, and the Navy is a logical answer to that question because it takes longer to build ships than it does the Army's equipment, then you have to adjust accordingly. But that can only be made, those decisions can only be made if you have a strategy in place and if you intend to follow it.
We've had a discussion with a few of our guests here, and you know, all our maritime bias aside, but when you look at where this country is going forward and where our security needs are, we really go back to the fact that we are a mercantile, roughly island nation with very secure land borders. And the discussion about how the pie goes up, I think it goes back to something that drives me nuts when people talk about it as if it's new and fresh. When it's not, it's actually a cold, dead hand, and that's Goldwater Nichols. It's well over 30 years old, and it's no longer a mechanism for reform. It's almost a barrier to us being able to get a really cohesive strategy and to allocate resources accordingly. My opinion is Goldwater Nichols in this whole joint concept, It's served its purpose. It needs to be replaced. It needs to be replaced with something that allows good, vigorous debate so that we can allocate what will be more tender resources. Because I think you outlined well in your article where you said that we really need a fleet of about 350 ships from 285. Now, I've seen some people, and I'm in agreement with them, that if we don't do something smart soon, we'll be lucky if we'll be at 220 by the time we get through with the 2020.
I've seen, yeah, the, yeah. You know, know, there are analysts at the Congressional Budget Office who put the number closer to 200, you know, looking 30 years out. And 30 years is, it sounds like a long time, but it's not.
It's tomorrow. How do we break the back of Goldwater Nichols and try to get something that's more appropriate to this century? And do you see any politicians out there that might be able to push this?
No, I don't. I don't see any politicians out there who are willing to push this. The political advantage of Goldwater Nichols is that it gives the appearance of fairness and equality. And that's fine, except that the appearance of fairness and equality in the budget and so on and so forth may not meet the strategic needs of the country. And that's why I think that the most important thing is to have a national strategic discussion. Where are we going and how are we going to get there? The Goldwater Nichols is a problem, but it doesn't have to be interpreted the way it's being interpreted. And the way it's being interpreted, the way it is being interpreted now, is that equality, the jointness means equality, equality in the budget, equality in operations, equality in participation. That doesn't have to be the way you interpret jointness. It's the way it's come to be interpreted. The larger question is strategy. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Where do the resources come from? What do they accomplish? If that kind of discussion takes place, then I think that the smaller one of today's interpretation of Goldwater Nichols will be bypassed. But as
a lot
politician taking this on, I don't see that. I don't see which politician. I mean, look at the debate right now. I mean, national politicians are focusing on a proposal of the governor of Wisconsin. Who's going to stand up and say, hey, wait a second, let's talk about Goldwater Nichols and get listened to?
Over at the blog Information Dissemination, Brian McGrath, who's been a guest on the show, talked about a New York Times editorial that appeared in praising some of Secretary Gates's proposed cuts to the services, although they also urged cutting back on the Virginia-class SSNs. If the New York Times is going to weigh in, is there some on these types of issues, which are strategic in their nature, is there a place where we can educate the editorial writers there about the importance of things like our fast attack submarines and other issues, and at least get them discussing it in rational terms instead of some kind of knee-jerk reaction?
No. Simple answer to that is no. The New York Times has views that are dictated less by strategy than their view of the defense budget and the role of the United States in the world in general. And when those views, they're not positive views of either the role of the United States in the world in general or of the defense budget specifically. So when they see opportunities where a budget can be cut and somebody with Gates's prominence comes along and says it should be, they're all fine with it. But to try to get them to see to educate them as you're talking, I think you could spend your time much more profitably elsewhere.
You also brought up an interesting point, and it's one of my hobby horses, is that the U.S. now seeks the appearance of alliances, but ultimately supplies the preponderance of boots on the ground itself. We've seen that in Afghanistan with our allies just caveat-laden troops, with the exception of the Brits, the Canadians, the Dutch while they were there, and the Estonians, you know, dogs and cats, the Danes here and there. We've seen that off the Horn of Africa, where ships will show up to join Task Force 150 or EU's Atlanta, but they can't do anything but observe and report like a mall cop. And the Navy continues to push what originally was a 1,000-ship Navy, now the Global Maritime Partnership, as if a frigate from one country is the same as an American frigate, is the same as an American destroyer. Is there any move to really take an objective view of what alliances really mean in this day and age, where nations do enough to get their flag in front of the headquarters, but they don't do so much so if it goes wrong, they can be blamed. We do the work, we get the blame.
Well, the interesting, the interesting point about this is that with Task Force 150, it's a naval coalition more than anything else, and traditionally, countries have been much more willing to fess up for naval activities than they have where it involves boots on the ground, for the obvious reason that the danger to personnel is less, or apparently so. And even that has limited results. You look at the once larger navies in Europe, and they're scrambling to find enough money to build, to keep their fleets from reducing quickly. British aircraft carriers, building British aircraft carriers would have meant, tying up the rest of their fleet and saving the money in operations that could be applied to building a carrier. They just don't have any money. They don't have any will. Or a large part of the population. I mean, what's the figure? The Royal Navy hasn't been this small since the 16th century.
Yep.
Where do you get your coalitions from? Gates says, Secretary of Defense says that our Navy is bigger than the next 11 combined. Well, okay, that's problematic because most of them have mostly coastal responsibilities, regional responsibilities. But that has a tremendous impact on what you're saying, which is the ships for partnerships are not forthcoming. They're not there. And they won't be in the future. Yeah.
It raises the great point. If their strategy involved letting us take care of the blue water while they focused on the inshore matters, which freed them up not to have to get larger ships and spend the money to go
the littoral issues are important, and their contribution is valued and appreciated, and it's a good thing. But where does that leave us, especially if the analysis of the budget crunchers are correct, which is that we're going to have a smaller and smaller fleet if you look at the 30-year window. And who around says that predicts that China is going to have a smaller fleet? And where does this leave us in large strategic terms? And I think the answer is very, very problematic.
Well, as we come towards the end of the show, just a couple minutes left here, Seth. If our listeners wanted to get hold and read more of your material, where would be a good place for them to start?
The Hudson website, hudson.org, has lists all the things that I've been written recently, and that's the best place to find it. Also, if you key in my name, you find articles that have been written recently on the net. And that will continue to be the case. I mean, I don't know any of the places that are everybody who's publishing, all magazines and journals, both certainly online and also hard copy, put up links to their authors' articles, to the articles that they have in their issues. So if you want to read the articles of anybody who's writing, the easiest way today is just put their name up and look on the internet.
Outstanding. And just a reminder to everybody is you can find a link to that over at my home blog. And Seth, thank you very much for coming in this Sunday to join us. Again, it's great to have you on as a guest, and it would be great to have you on for longer, but that just gives us an excuse to invite you again in the future.
It's a pleasure, and I think you're doing a really great service by informing people about this. People listen. I mean, that's that. If that doesn't work, we're sunk. Forget it.
Well, thank you very much, Seth, and have a
great
week.
My pleasure, Dick. You too.
Thank you, Seth. Good night.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live and for joining in the chat room. Please join us next week for another edition of MidRats. Have a great Navy Day.